In this episode, we speak with Dr. Brendan Nichols, who teaches postcolonial African literature at the University of Leeds. We speak with James Curry, who was editor-in-charge of the African Writers series at Heinemann from 1967 to 1984. And we speak with Mugabe Bienke, a writer based in Kampala, Uganda, the author of Dear Philomena. In this episode, we talk about the role of literature and the role of writers, and most importantly, the role of language. We also talk about the Makerere African Writers Conference, a pivotal conference in 1962 that brought together writers from all over Africa. And we talk about the adoption of colonial languages by African states. We also look at the role of the writer in an unjust society and talk about writing and its impact on society, particularly the African society in general. So now we speak with Dr. Brendan Nichols, who is Associate Professor in Postcolonial African Literature at the University of Leeds.
So hi, Brendan. Thank you for joining me. The very first question is, what exactly do you think is the power of the African novel in shaping global dialogue when it burst onto the scene in the 1960s?
So that's a great question. The first wave of writers, you know, sort of really opened up an insight into how African people's communities lived or might live, what their realities were, what their imaginative powers and reach were. So someone like Achebe, who has to go back to almost a moment while colonialism is setting in and things fall apart, opens, you know, the eyes of the world onto African spaces, African communities, African complexities, which perhaps had not been at the forefront of people's minds before. And someone like Ngugi, I know that his first couple of novels sold over 100,000 copies. Wow. You know, and that's phenomenal for, you know, very, very early 1960s books. So, you know, these are people who reach far beyond the continent and who also open up lay readers' eyes to the injustices and the history of colonialism in what I'd want to call a humanizing way. You know, you get to recognize not just the systemic injustice of colonialism, but also its impacts on real men and women. And its lasting legacies as the novel kind of gathers, you know, momentum in the 70s and 80s. And someone like Ngugi is looking at kind of contemporary neocolonialism and how colonialism may have ended as a formal political arrangement, but it continues in a new form as a remote economic form of expropriation. And, you know, as someone who's keen on African literature, the present time is almost like no other. You know, we've seen a bursting onto the scene of global figures who are now international celebrities and opinion makers in their own rights. Someone like Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, the late Binyavanga Wainaina, you know, more recently Ayobami Adebayo, just a couple of years back, Akwa Eke Emezi with Freshwater. These are books that are just gripping new generations of readers. My students are, you know, rapturous when they're reading these books. Nnedi Okorafor is another one. Yvonne Owuor, you know, I could go on and on. It's just, it's a wonderful, wonderful time. And I always say about African literature that we just get the best books. So it's twice as good.
Exactly. But then around this period, the novel itself was considered a European creation. And the idea that Africans are using this European medium to tell African stories, how does that, in your view, how do you think that starts with the writers?
I think it's a complex relationship because someone like Ngugi, you know, his first couple of novels read very much like well-crafted English liberal, maybe with a small L, novels. And for that reason, you know, people were interested, readers were interested, but there was always that kind of dismissive line of, well, if I want to read a good novel, why don't I go to, you know, name someone, Joseph Conrad, Virginia Woolf. And so I think that, you know, that kind of the adoption of that form had to kind of comprehend at a certain point almost the breaking of the form and a kind of remaking of it or a modernist experiment that was distinctively African. So something like, you know, when Ngugi moves to a grain of wheat, or much later when he moves to Devil on the Cross, you see a kind of breaking of the terms of recognition and an act of creativity that says, you know, I'm a distinctive voice in my own right. I may have something like, you know, a modernist project in a grain of wheat. People might recognize similarities with Conrad or whoever. But at the same time, what's being worked with there is the Mau Mau emergency, a community that has experienced disruption, that is having to find a shared past so that it can go forward with the project of independence, and who are finding that shared past through layers of trauma and violation and through acts of confession to each other. So it's a tricky legacy. And, you know, my kind of approach to it is, well, it's, you know, the early generations were not imitative. They were pioneers in their own right. And that's borne out by their later directions. Someone like a Chairbear, I think, is very, very good at working across different traditions. So things fall apart. You know, the most kind of informed, philosophically Igbo narrative you might hope to find, the entire kind of value system there is you know, distinctively Nigerian. But mm-hmm. at the same time, is modeling this on William Butler Yeats's poem, The Second Coming, and the idea of sort of millennial cycles in history. And in Achebe's hands, you know, totally different, seemingly different, supposedly different traditions are just put together effortlessly and speak to one another. So I think two different possible approaches. One is to renovate form, and the other is to say, well, actually, story is big enough to almost break the terms of the debate. But neither one is right. And then you've got an interesting figure, like, say, not so much a novelist, but the poet Christopher Okibo, who starts with what seems like a T.S. Eliot-like high modernist experiment. And then the Biafran War happens, and suddenly his form changes. And suddenly this new voice bursts through, and it's far more immediate and urgent and insistent. So you can almost see in real time, insofar as poetry is ever real time, a kind of adaption to the environment around the poet, which makes him all the more fascinating. So someone, you know, like Okibo is fascinating for just how he can hinge out of what seems like a supposedly derivative project. I think he's better than Eliot, so it's not derivative. And into a whole new voice just born by what's happening at the level of a historical wave that's kind of sweeping over him.
Exactly. I mean, just to segue, so around this period, you started having new platforms being created by Africans and African institutions to showcase their writing. So you had stuff like Transition Magazine, founded by Rajat Nyoji in 61 in Uganda. And in Nigeria, you had Black Orpheus in Ibadan, which was started by the university professor Uli Baya, and had editors like Wole Soyinka actually edited both magazines. So this takes us to 1962 and the Makerere African Writers Conference. This was sort of like an arrival, if I may use that term, for all the writers to come together and decide what the raison d'etre is for moving forward. How important was that conference in your view?
I think it's absolutely huge. So you've got, you know, 62 is a year after the formation of Umkhonto weSizwe in South Africa.
Yeah, exactly.
And you've got South African writers going north of the border. You've got people like Ezekiel Mpahlele, you've got Bloke Manasani, Arthur Maimani, you know, Dennis Brutus, an entire generation of greats, you know, just moving northwards to think about their voices and to think about their literary projects. And then from outside of South Africa, you've got just a roll call of, you know, wonderful, wonderful writers. You've got Achebe, you've got Soyinka, you've got John Pepper Clarke, Obi Wally, who comes out in you know, questioning what African literature is and whether it should be written in English or not. You've got Okara, Okibo, you know, so, you know, Ngugi's there as well. And mm-hmm. from what I can recall, presents his Chinua Achebe with, you know, copies of his manuscripts mm-hmm. and is published shortly afterwards. Yeah, and even Langston Hughes from America. So you've got, you know, Grace Argoff, Rebecca Njau, Dave Rubadiri. It's a roll call
exactly.
of titans. And, you know, the lasting legacy is that, you know, people like Mpahlele and Nkosi and Brutus take away from this, you know, the literary energies that are happening, you know, far north of the border in transnational forums like this. And you've got writers with, you know, renewed energy, someone like Ngugi bursting onto the scene just after the conference. And, you know, the way I was taught African literature years back was that, you know, if you read a writer like, say, Achebe, you had to read him within a national framework. So you had to read Achebe, the Nigerian writer, what does project contribute to Nigeria at this particular moment? And yet what we see in that conference is a transnational gathering where it's not about national boundaries. It's about, you know, a generation of writers from multiple geographies coming together and sharing a vision and sharing a moment and debating, of course, what the future direction of African literature should be for them. And it's a kind of coming into their own, you know, as writers and as public figures. And, you know, I can't think of a similar kind of event in our contemporary present. And the legacies, of course, you know, the 70s, the 80s, we just see African literature go from strength to strength and broaden its base. And I think that something of that has to do with those energies from, you know, creative exchange.
Indeed, exactly. I mean, all of them were exits in this imperialist structure and fashioning the new world for themselves, you know, not just for themselves, but for people who were reading their writing and being guided by what was on the page put by this writer. Then the conference had, you know, very critical discussion, which is should Africans write in the language of the Europeans and the colonizers, or should they keep on writing in their own language? And you had two distinct schools of thought. You know, those that said, well, the whole idea of what Nigeria is fake. It's created by the British. There is no Nigeria before the British. There's no way for someone who is, say, Yoruba to speak to someone who is Ogoni, for example, unless they use European languages like English. And they have to write in this language so they can reach as many people as possible. And you also have those who say, well, that's nonsense. We've had our language, we've used this language to tell stories since time immemorial, and we must continue with this our language. So, you know, I mean, it's always put like a Chinua Achebe Ngugi sort of divide, but could you add some more nuance to the discussion?
I think it's one of those fascinating moments where perhaps there might not even be a correct answer to which side of the debate is right in principle. You know, I think the Achebe versus Ngugi position is possibly neither of them would recognize a strict conflict between their positions, maybe. Mm. And I think, you know, Achebe obviously comes out very famously and says, I've been given the English language and I intend to use it. It will be, you know, the kind of English language that I speak as an African, but I still intend to use it. And then you've got Ngugi sort of later in his career coming to the decision to write in Gikuyu, his first language, and saying, you know, English is the language of the colonizer. English as a global language is also, you know, homogenizing culture and promoting only one form of cultural riches. And those cultural riches are not ours. And does not, you know, derive from our very, very long tradition of story and philosophy and wisdom. And therefore, Ngugi says, you know, I'm going to come out and write in Gikuyu, and I'm going to use Gikuyu forms, Gikuyu folktales, Gikuyu songs. And eventually, even, of course, when he does his play in Kamiritu, you know, sort of going out to the communities themselves and giving them a part in the creative process. So, you know, two different systems of value. I've got a lot of time for Ngugi's position that, you know, Gikuyu as a language, as a, almost like a repository of story and wisdom and cultural wealth, needs to be promoted on its own terms. And it's logical then that his kind of advocacy, you know, as the next phase of his kind of language project was to say, well, let's have multiple centers of translation. Let's translate Gikuyu into, you know, Urdu. Let's translate, you know, a Swahili text into Zulu and sort of disturb the center, move the center by creating multiple centers, which as an approach to the problem of power and homogenizing language as power is absolutely ingenious. And he's never, Ngugi, he's never turned his back on the English language. He just wants it in its proper proportion, from what I've been able to tell. Exactly. Someone like a Chebe can, you know, by slipping in Igbo proverbs, by slipping in words that he might not even translate, but that you get from the context, I think moves readers who might otherwise be ignorant towards African story. And one of the things I really appreciate about his work is the fact that the proverbs, the stories, the anecdotes, the folk tales that he slides in there, number one, can theorize the novel that you're reading in real time as you're reading it. The moment you think about the story and use it to interpret the novel, you unlock the novel in all sorts of interesting ways. But also that as forms of theory, these move. So they can be context dependent and can theorize multiple moments in the book, which is a very, very sophisticated project. So I think I've got sympathy for both positions. And of course, that debate has raged. You know, I've even, when I was last at an African Literature Association conference a few years back, there were still people debating these questions in conversation. So it's, as a legacy to leave, it's not a bad one at all.
It's a good essay question, basically.
well, yes. And you know, also some of the afterlives, someone like, say, Okara, who writes in, you know, Ijaw syntax, but English language, or someone like Ken Sariwa, who half invents a language in Sojaboy. You know, and that's picked up by much later writers like Iweala with Beasts of No Nation, or is kind of made more complicated by, say, Chris Abanian's Song for Night, where he's got a narrator who has had his vocal cords severed because he's a minesweeper and they don't want him to cry out if one of his companions dies. But he writes in English, but is telling us that he's thinking in Igbo and communicates to his friends with sign language because he doesn't have a voice. You know, the whole language question there just takes on a whole new level.
Interesting. But I guess this takes us to the next thing, which is the recognition, if I may use that word, of African writing by the Nobel Committee. When Wole Soyinka was awarded the prize in 1986, in case it's listened to 1,000 years from now, 1986. and he was awarded... So, in their words, he, in a wide cultural perspective and with poetic overtones, fashions the drama of existence. Wole Soyinka really is, I don't really like glorifying the writer's life, but he's lived the quintessential writer's life, you know, everything really, and he's very prolific. Mm. But how important was this prize for the world in how they viewed African literature? And how important do you think this was for the Africans who wrote to see someone who, you know, came from their own tradition, recognized on what many people believe in the writing world is the highest stage, the Nobel Prize for Literature?
I mean, it's a groundbreaking moment because it tears down the barriers and says that African writing can be as important, as world-leading, as writing from anywhere else in the world. And, you know, I remember getting to university and people still being enthused by Soyinka having won the prize. And then while I was there, Gordimer won it as well. And then years later, I think it was later, Coetzee won it. And so this real kind of excitement, you know, where Soyinka had broken down the barriers, but it was followed by successive writers. I'm slightly grumpy with the Nobel Prize for Literature. I'll tell you why. They gave it to Bob Dylan instead of Ngugi.
Really?
Yeah. So many of us have been wanting Ngugi to win the prize for a number of years now, and we keep asking why he's not done so. You know, Achebe sadly passed away, so never received it. And Ngugi is, you know, sort of one of the ones that we think, you know, should...
From that generation.
Yeah, should still be honored, and on literary terms as much as anything else. And he's paid a very high price for his craft in lots of ways, has Ngugi. And he's also, you know, widened the horizons of the possible for generations of students. I can still remember teaching Ngugi. And this is just as South Africa had got democracy. And the kids were just so excited. It was like the moment, you know, of their, I think it was second year of their degree, had just arrived in being able to read his work. and talk about it and think about it and form opinions. So I'd like to think that Chewenka has torn down the barriers, and I would like to think that they'd keep coming down, and that, you know, Ngugi would receive his due recognition. If history proves that he doesn't, there are no shortage of talented writers, and I would fully expect to see more of them. But coming back to Chewenka, he's lived an exemplary life in many ways, and is a master of multiple crafts. You know, poetry, drama, memoir, the novel. There's almost nothing that he cannot do. And he's outspoken as well.
Very outspoken.
he's never known to sort of withhold an opinion where one could be offered. But also kind of with it has a kind of dignity and bearing. He came to speak at my university, Leeds, where I work. And I was sat right down opposite him on the dinner table and was just waiting to kind of just hear the great man speak. And some professor said to me, "Brendan, you need to move aside so we can have an appropriate balance around this table." So I got shifted off to the edge. Anyways, they said, "Oh, we need someone to take Chewenka to the airport tomorrow." And my hand just went straight up. So I took him for a nice quiet drive out to Leeds Bradford Airport. We didn't say a great deal to each other. I knew he was tired. But at the airport, I said to him, "You know, Prof, could I, you know, please have a photograph?" And he said, "Yeah, just as long as no one's looking." And it was one of my proudest moments, and for him to be the first to win such a great distinction, it's very, very deserved. And I look forward to many, many more prizes to many deserving writers.
Indeed. And I think the next thing now is basically how writers from his generation sort of, lay down the foundations of what is being taught within that academic space to students who study and grow up on the continent. So they basically laid down what exactly was literature and what could be taught in schools, in universities, mm-hmm. in colleges, and, in writing the language of empire, entrenching the language of empire. So how important were the schools in creating this new period? Because around this period, we started seeing states, African states, basically borrowing these languages and deciding this is how we're going to move forward. If you're in Ivory Coast, you're going to speak French as a national language. If you're in Angola, it's Portuguese. If you're in Ghana, it's English. And all these writers had to fit in into these contexts. So how important was this in entrenching or disentrenching the languages?
It's a fascinating question. It's one I keep coming back to. If you read Ngugi on his education, he says, the English language was his passport to the middle class, and because he could speak English well, he got a place in university. Whereas someone who he knew who was good at another subject, I forget if it was mathematics or the sciences, ended up working on a matatu in Nairobi, because that form of knowledge was not valued. What was being looked for was, very much in line with Macaulay's minister in India, a buffer class who would do the work of or would help colonialism do its work through indigenous representatives. So there's that kind of paralyzing. Need to acquire colonial systems of value and to master them in order to succeed educationally. But also the paradoxical gift of once you have assimilated the language, it becomes a literary passport to anywhere the moment you publish. Your ideas and your works, can spread as far as the circulation of your book. The other thing I've kind of been going back to quite recently is a non-literary figure who lived in present-day Zimbabwe, but he was born 1903 and came through a mission school. And I've done a little bit of tracking of the history. I'm looking to try and find records of him in the archive. And you can see photos. It was a mission school, so there's a local kind of order of religious training, which is very local to me. And I've driven down the motorway 5 minutes and sort of gone and sat there and looked at these photographs from the late 1890s when this mission school was opened through to about the 1920s when this guy would have left. And what you can see is a sort of a transformation in the kids. First of all, they start out wearing one of the guys got his dad's jacket on, but they've cut off the arms, so it's, you know, it's not too big for him. And then within 5-10 years, you see kids in school uniforms. You see kids, you know, obviously getting proper meals. The school's got a proper building. So it's kind of paradoxical. You know, once you're part of an institution like that, very often there are forms of advantage, you know, even a good meal or clothes that fit you that they bring with them. And yet at the same time, doing that estranging ideological work that can take you away from the community of which you're part. And I think, you know, Ngugi came to realize in you know, especially around about the time of the mid-70s to early 80s, when he increasingly indigenizes the novel, when he increasingly wants to go out and work with communities. You know, he's realized by that point the kinds of class estrangement that you know, an English education can build into one. And he, you know, as much as anyone else, has done that work of trying to undo that, his own ideological formation. So it's a difficult question, because you can see in the historical record, you know, practical upliftment for very often communities. The one I'm looking at, that, you know, there's no one else there other than the Portuguese just over the border who got rebuffed by the community. And these missionaries going out and, you know, sort of building in, you know, an artificial form of belief into these kids, while at the same time, you know, giving them nutrition, giving them clothing. In some cases, from this guy I've tracked, his name's John Chafavumbira, you know, the association with the school and with, you know, the Anglican Church, as it is in Southern Africa, seems, yeah, from what I've been able to find, to have provided him with an infrastructure, no matter where he went, so that he could sort of use the church almost to find work when he needed an income. So it's a strange sort of a, you know, infrastructure that, it's, you know, even as it gifts you with opportunity, at the same time, you know, sort of works to quieten down sometimes political rebellion. You know, the orthodox line in, you know, many of Ngugi's critiques of Christianity is that, you know, you wait until after you've passed away from this world before you receive your reward for being a good, quiet colonial subject, which is why he speaks about religion as being the, you know, the spiritual arm of the imperialist project. And one of the things I found interesting in Kenya, and, you know, sort of prior to the Mau Mau revolution there, is that, you know, due to falling out between the missionaries and the Gikuyu community in the 1930s, the community actually sets up its own churches and they set up their own schools, the Karingo or pure schools, where they teach a version of both religion and education that is much more centered towards a kind of a nationalist project. And some of the leaders of Mau Mau came through those schools or were teachers in them. So, you know, the institutions themselves can be transformed, can be reinvented to do positive political work. And, you know, there are historical examples of that. But it's a very, very complex question, you know, in terms of kind of the legacies of an education in schooling and languages of empire.
Now we listen to a recording of Chinua Achebe on the impact of language on modern African society.
And talking of dispossession, what about language itself? Does my writing in the language of my colonizer not amount to acquiescing in the ultimate dispossession? This is a big and complex matter which we cannot go into fully here. Let me simply say that when at the age of 13, I went to that school modeled after British public schools, it was not only English literature that I encountered there. I came in contact also for the first time in my life with a large number of other boys of my own age who did not speak my Igbo language. And they were not foreigners, but fellow Nigerian youth. We lived in the same dormitories, attended the same morning assembly and classes, and in the evenings gathered in the same playing fields. To be able to do all that, we had to put away our different mother tongues and communicate in the language of our colonizers. This paradox was not peculiar to Nigeria. It happened in every colony where the British put diverse peoples together under one administration. Some of my colleagues today, finding this too awkward, have tried to rewrite their story into a straightforward case of oppression by presenting a happy monolingual African childhood brusquely disrupted by the imposition of a domineering foreign language. This historical fantasy demands that we throw out the English language in order to restore linguistic justice and self-respect to ourselves. My position is that anyone who feels unable to be able to do all that, we had to put away our different mother tongues and communicate in the language of our colonizers.
So now we speak with James Corey, who was editor in charge of the African Writers series at Heinemann from 1967 to 1984, working with writers as diverse as Chinua Achebe, Dambudzo Marechera, and Ngugi wa Thiong'o.
This was the first time all these people had been able to come face to face. It was a marvelous invitation. I couldn't go myself, but we were the New African, of which I was a founder editor, was invited, and Neville Rubin represented us there. Randolph Vine was the editor, but he couldn't go because he was banned.
Interesting. I mean, in a nutshell, what would you say is the most important thing to come out of that conference? Why do you think that conference was so important?
Well, it was of enormous excitement that everything had happened very quickly in the previous couple of years because of this funding by Congress of Cultural Freedom in Paris.
Yeah.
With the mystery.
Mystery money. Everyone,
they suddenly seemed to have a lot of money. Everybody said it was fraud. But I know where
exactly. Interesting. I mean, they funded Black Orpheus, the Transition magazine. They funded a bunch of things actually around the same time.
Yes, and we, the New African in Cape Town, were funded by the Farfield Foundation, who got their money from the Congress of Cultural Freedom.
Yeah. Interesting.
Gugi said that when we accepted a story by him, it was terribly important to him that he, as a young Kenyan student, was having his writing read in Cape Town.
That must have been so interesting to him. I mean, every writer's dream is to be read. And this was the early 60s. For him to be read in Cape Town at that time must have been very exciting for him as a young man.
Yes.
So just talk a bit about who was present at the conference. I mean, at the time, many of the people that are household names now were not that big. There was a community of people floating around who were all in the writing space. But at that time, who were the big names big names that people were looking forward to seeing.
I mean, nobody was a big name at that stage, but I mean, Chinua Achebe was the biggest because his book had been published. His Things Fall Apart was published in 1958, But nobody knew about it in Africa until Alan Hill started the African Writer Series, and Chinua's first two books were published in 1962. But Gugi was to become the other big name, but Gugi was just a student. And he very humbly came to Chinua's door in the catering rest house, and he said, "Look, could you read these two manuscripts of novels, Weep Not Child and The River Between?" And Chinua did look at them immediately at breakfast, said to Van Milne, who was from representing Heinemann Publishers in London, he said, "Look, he's really worth taking seriously, this chap. He knows what he's about." So that Gugi was much younger than Achebe, but in a way, those were the two of the important. Another important person who came to that conference was Christopher Akibo, from Eastern Nigeria.
He was there.
Yes, he was there, and in fact, there are quite a lot of stories about him. He was quite a character.
He was indeed.
Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, I know Langston Hughes was also there.
Langston Hughes, yes. Certainly, there were several Black Americans, and people in Africa were very excited about these new young American writers like Langston Hughes, and so it was just a time when it was. Just gave everybody an enormous confidence that they were, it's always difficult. All these young writers, both from Africa and the Americas, they were at least they'd found one another. Nobody else knew about them, but they found one another.
Exactly. They found their tribe.
Yes, that's right. It was the great writer's tribe.
I was actually wondering, why Makerere?
Well, why was it there?
Yes, exactly. Why was it held in Makerere?
Well, I think it was particularly because of Rajat Neoji and Transition, who was supported by Congress of Cultural Freedom, and when, as you know, there was immense amount of Mbari activity in Ibadan, and not just Ibadan, but Enugu, Lagos, Mbari Club was in Ibadan and was the headquarters, they linked up with Transition, and the Congress of Cultural Freedom funded them.
Mm. This is Uli Baya and the team in Ibadan at the time.
You're right to mention Uli Baya. He marvelous initiatives he took, and he had a real talent for getting things done, getting things started, getting money coming. Yeah,
he did. I think he edited the Penguin Book of Modern African Poetry.
Yeah, but that's minor compared with that's a record of him being deeply involved. But you're quite right. It, the Penguin, which of course was the famous imprint, well, still is, but nevertheless, in those days it was even more important. There was few, and it was just starting to look at Africa. With this, as you will remember, was a very crucial period, because it was the period of independence, 1957,
Ghana,
1960, Nigeria, and then the East Africans, and then the Southern Africans, and it was an intoxicating time to be involved, because suddenly everything was moving, and this great conference. And of course, there was a conference at the same time of French-speaking writers in Dakar, in Senegal. The thing that happened, which was very important afterwards, was that the there were follow-up conferences when it was decided, again funded by Congress for Cultural Freedom, and there was scholars, high-ranking academics from the new universities in Africa. Mm. They had a meeting at which they decided that books by new writers from Africa should be used by examination boards for set books, and that libraries should collect them, and so on. Whereas the Francophone writers decided that with their French advisors, decided that writing by this first generation of African writers could be studied as Francophone studies or as anthropology, but couldn't be used in schools and universities and colleges as books to study. Mm. So there was a big difference between the Francophone authorities and the Anglophone authorities. And this conference, there was another one in Dakar, that I don't think that is the one that people talk about now. I've seen very few references to it recently. But people still talk about the Makerere conference.
Yes.
Of course, the thing was, Makerere, Kampala, was pretty central in Africa for people to come from all directions. The crucial airport was at Entebbe in Uganda, and so it was easy, it was sensible to use Makerere, with the new university college on the outskirts of Kampala.
Interesting. And also at the time, I think 1962 was when Uganda just got its independence, yeah? And Obote was in charge.
Yes. Yes. Well, there's a lot of history after that, but...
story for another day.
It was an exciting time.
Indeed. I mean, also at the conference, was where three critical questions were discussed. So, I mean, the first was, what exactly is African literature? Should Africans write in the language of their colonizers? And should it depict the African experience true and true in terms of what they're attempting to do? And different writers had different points of view on this. Achebe, for example, had his view that Africans should write in English, those from the Anglophone sphere, because, you know, the fact that they write in English is not a mark on their writing, because they intend to do unheard of things with the language.
Mm.
But in your view, what exactly came out of this conference in terms of what is African literature? Should they write in the language of Europeans? And should the Africans really describe their situation through and through?
Well, let me go to the question. Googie was always central to this question.
Yes,
he wrote several novels, plays in English, but in 1976, quite a long time later, Heinemann, as I was running the African Writers series, Heinemann had a big launch. Henry Chikava was the new 30-year-old managing director of the Heinemann company there. We had 700 or 800 people in the city hall in Nairobi. And in his speech, Googie said, look, I say on this occasion that I am in future going to write in the language that my peasant mother, my little peasant mother, will be able to understand. I am going to write in future in my own language. And that was a very dramatic and important statement. Mm. And in fact, Henry Chikava and he worked together on all his writing after that. And then Henry Chikava, head of the Heinemann Company in Nairobi, sold the rights to us in London and to the Heinemann Company in America and so on. But the originating publisher was Henry Chikava in Nairobi, supported by Googie. And he moved that debate on back in 1962 in the conference. The trouble was you really had to use colonial languages. I don't know. It's interesting to me because we started at Heinemann Arab authors as a separate series.
Mm.
Status of Arabic. Arabic was an invading language, just like Portuguese, English, French. Less Spanish, but
indeed. And also around the time was when you started having the rise of Pan-Arabism, post the Suez Crisis and Nasser.
Yes.
And there was that, you know, Arab pride in terms of literature and film.
Yes. And of course, broadcasting was terribly important. After the Suez Crisis, what was it called? Voice of Cairo, or whatever. Anyhow, the Egyptian station became very famous, and it was copied in Ghana by Nkrumah. Already before. So this is 5 years before this conference about writing. Broadcasting was already beginning to make a terribly important mark in the period of decolonization.
Exactly, that's very interesting. Also, I think the conference, as you rightly said, was populated with a lot of different writers. You had a few characters there. I mean, are there any stories about things that happened, any anecdotes of interesting events that occurred during the conference?
I'm quite frankly, of course, I wasn't there. I've been reading up in various books about entries about it. I think the answer is I can't really remember, except that I know that Akibo made some very provocative remark on poetry, which gave everybody a lot. But I can't actually offhand remember it. It's worth looking it up.
That's interesting. Yes, and I mean, this post the conference, we segue into the African Writers series. In your opinion, how important was the series for the continent?
How important was the series for?
For the continent, the African Writers series.
Well, I think it's going to be interesting this program, BBC Radio 4 on, called Africa Turns the Pages, the novels that shaped a continent. That's big statement for a TV program. So
I agree wholeheartedly. I think it's a very important, innovation.
For me, there were two absolutely. The Africans were on the whole dismissed in America and in Europe, two tremendous successes. One, as we are saying, we're looking forward to this program. The novels that shaped a continent. Well, that's a big. But the other thing is music, particularly popular music, that's been one of the most interesting, lively, creative parts of African achievement in the last half century.
I agree. And around the time of the 60s, I mean, you had High Life. That was very popular back then. Jazz as well was filtering through. Well,
jazz is a heroic hero.
yeah.
Although that sort of, it was the way that led on to people. I mean, in Cape Town, when I was there in the early 60s, he used to play under the name Dollar Brand, and he's famous. I saw him on television the other night, and he's. It was very exciting in Cape Town, the initiatives of people, I think every African country, and of course whatever their colonial history, it tended to contribute to music. And the marvelous thing that we wanted to do, Chinua Achebe, Keith Sambrook was absolutely creatively important. He was the person who first published Googie, and what we wanted was to encourage people to have the confidence that they could get published by a renowned London publisher. And we rather succeeded. One of the most successful things was putting a photograph. At that time, Penguins used to have a photograph of the author on the back. Mm-hmm. And we just copied them, and we thought that was a good idea. But I think it was terribly important, you know, that young Africans could go into a bookshop, and in those days they were absolutely piles of African writer series in all the campus bookshops in particular, and they could get encouraged, and they could see that Africans were getting published. They tried, tried people, and Chinua was terribly important because he always said, "Look, for instance, I showed him the manuscript when I first met him. Showed him the manuscript of Taib Saleh's Wedding of Zayn, and he looked at the manuscript. And he said, "This man can write." He said, "In any case, we haven't got any novels from Sudan. We'll do it, you know." And this was marvelous because he, Alan Hill, our managing director, he had realized, he thought he was going to be patted on the back when he went to Nigeria, and everybody would say, "Oh, fancy you, how clever of you to publish Chinua Achebe." And nobody knew about Chinua Achebe. So Alan Hill thought, "What we want is a Penguins for Africa." And that's what we did. We made all the fiction orange, like penguins, it wasn't very original, but it was, you know, that in a way we voted ourselves the extension of Penguins in Africa. We had no ownership connections at all.
Yeah, and of course you publish nonfiction as well. As well as poetry,
in the African Writers series.
Yes.
Well, yes. Some biography, but we never really really set to that in a big way. It was Kenneth Callender's one of the first four books, Kenneth Callender's "Zambia Shall Be Free." Well, it did us a great deal of good, and then
Steve Biko, "I Write What I Like."
Biko, yes. Well, I remember crossing in front in London. I was crossing the steps of the American Embassy. And one of a South African woman who was very an activist came tearing down the steps saying, "This is a crisis. You know, fancy them killing Steve Biko." And, you know, it was a very... Anyhow, we were very fortunate in that we had some good editors who selected Biko's writings. That was very important. Yes, as you say.
Yes, he was very instrumental for the struggle.
Oh yeah,
against apartheid.
Yes,
it was a blue when he passed away.
Yes, no, tragically, yes.
Also, just to also segue, and how important was the process of choosing who to publish, who not to publish? Because we only see those people that were published. Were there a lot of people that were turned down?
Well, what I should have mentioned earlier was that we at the 10th anniversary in 1972, we decided that Chinua Achebe had been editorial advisor for the first 100, and then we decided that Ige Higo, a managing director, poet himself from Ibadan in Nigeria, and Henry Chikava in Nairobi, and I would form a triumvirate. We would all bring, except, well, bring in, encourage people to submit manuscripts, and then we would have them read by readers in our own area, and then we would we had literally hundreds of manuscripts being submitted, and you had to sort of select what seemed to be good to have reports on and get local reports, and then we would all swap the reports around the three companies. It was the day that when photocopiers came in, and it was and I certainly saw that the money that Heinemann was making out of it was well recycled into lots and lots of photocopying and airmailing and so on. Took a lot of time and energy, and but it was marvelous to be so, you know, just so much work by people who had, you know, never submitted manuscripts before and so on, and it really was amazing how much was worthwhile. But we had to be careful about, we couldn't do too many, although
exactly
we got up to 15-20 a year, that was all three companies. We'd decide on those, and each company would buy part of the print run, and all sorts of people would volunteer to read. We did pay them small fees, but actually what I said was, look, even if you want to dismiss a book in five lines, we'll pay you the fee as long as you give us good ones on the ones you want to get published. You know. Mm. So we really did spend an enormous amount. It was really of energy and time and money on selecting. I mean, of course, by the time I left in, Heinemann set up my own business in 1984. Mm-hmm. There were 270 titles, and it was some quite an achievement.
Exactly, it was indeed. I mean, you mentioned Chinua Achebe a bunch of times, and he was the first founding editor, and he was very instrumental in bringing people together. Yes. But in your opinion, how important was he? Because you worked with him personally. His energy, especially in the early stages, how important was that?
Well, the really important thing was that he had a very clear view. But he was enthusiastic, and he had the ear of Alan Hill. Alan Hill used to say, "Well, what does the old Chinua say?" And we'd all laugh because we knew the old Chinua. It was the Biafran War when, and often Chinua was flying through from the Uli airstrip. He was then flying from Lisbon and London to the United States to raise money. And I would keep a pile of the forthcoming, the probable books we ought to choose. And he'd ring from Heathrow early in the morning, and I'd just phone him back because one was on the phone for an hour or so with him going through it. That he had, you often have a bit of time between flights, and so he could do it. He had not enough time to get into London, but anyhow, he was always very generous and with his time and everything else, and the fact that he also was so respected by our managing director, Alan Hill, was important. And Keith Sandbrook, too. I'd come back. I only saw Chinua for the first time in at the end of the Biafran War. I went to the University of Nigeria to see him on campus there.
Yeah, I mean, he must have been exhausted around that period. I think another question would be, at the conference it was decided more or less to write in English. Why wasn't the prize invented? You know, sort of like the Cervantes Prize for writing, outstanding writing in the Spanish language, was invented in 76. Is there a reason why there wasn't something like that created at that conference? Or it was just an oversight?
Well, you can't do everything at once, but he, the NOMA Award was very important, which the African Books Collective in Oxford, Mary J. there, and Hansel, they managed to get that funded by a Japanese publisher, and that became quite a big event each year. I think there were certainly every now and again I hear or are reminded of prizes. It's not something I really done much work on. Well, I share the way you have really rated the importance of that conference, I think it, I really don't remember anything else in literature, and it really it took off so fast. It was really absolutely marvelous that, and I think without that, I think the growth of writing in Africa would have been very much slower. Conferences often, people do lots of talking and the one or two important things kind of come out of it. But I think this conference was overall so important in terms of making people think, my goodness, these Africans can write.
So now we listen to a recording of Wole Soyinka on the role of a writer.
It's one of the many functions of the writer. Essentially, I define my role as a writer. I think one can only speak individually. I mean, there are writers who prefer to interpret society on a very neutral ground, so to speak.
I think I remember you saying somewhere that you would, in fact, have liked to be a sort of quiet writer in a quiet period, writing quietly and getting on quietly with your writing. And is there a kind of writer? Is there a kind of writer, a kind of person who is inevitably drawn in this way? Do you think, I'm trying really to ask you to generalise when you don't want to, but do you feel there is in all writers something which, if it were working properly, would make him intervene in this way in society?
I suspect so. I think writers, at least, well, let me speak for myself. I find basically I'm a very lazy kind of writer. You know, in other words, I'd sooner not be exerted in one direction or another. But then a crisis engulfs both him and his society, and then he responds as a man and as a writer.
So now we speak with Mugabe Biankya, who is a writer based in Kampala, Uganda. He's the author of the best-selling work, Dear Philomena.
The literature across, like, because like the continent is huge, you know, like
huge, vast.
Yeah. And so like I can only speak on like the limited breadth of knowledge that I know and like have. But like from the time when independence started popping off around like the 60s for most of the continent, right? Because like it was like late 50s, early 60s that like pretty much most of the continent started gaining independence from the colonial powers. And that was around the same time that we had these first big seminal literary works in English or in French or in Portuguese or in the colonizers' languages by Africans. Because that's around the same time Things Fall Apart comes out. That's around the same time that the Song of Lawino, Song of Achol comes out. Like all these huge like literary classics across the African continent come out around the same time Africans are getting independence. And all of them are pretty much very, very anti-colonial in their rhetoric. They're very, very much like pushing that like anti-colonial framework and that message forward. And all of them were very, very, very political figures and were very, very politically active, which is a difference that I've noticed over time. Because like back then, like Ngugi wa Thiong'o was getting imprisoned left, right, and center by the Kenyan government, you know? Like,
that's true.
And like, but like that was common because Ken Saro-Wiwa was doing the same thing, you know? Like Achebe, same thing. Okudbitek, same thing. Like all of these like huge writers were all like facing a lot of oppression from their governments. And a lot of them ended up fleeing to the West on asylum or like, you know, because of persecution. And then were writing from there and becoming like celebrated from there, which like was like, it's one of those like parallels that like you clearly see where like, you know, the writers are strongly, strongly anti-colonial, brutally oppressed activists at the same time that there is this anti-colonial sentiment going forward. But the difference is once we became independent nations and were no longer colonies, then the writers started attacking the elite, you know, the people
exactly
in who were oppressing different
who slotted into that role
and who were doing the same thing that the colonizers were doing, you know,
even worse in certain instances.
Yeah, worse. Honestly. But like they were happy with it when it was against the colonizers, but when it was against them, that's when they started now cracking down, and that's why they all had to flee. But that has continued throughout, honestly, I believe, like, time. I think that the main difference is that these figures may not be as like well known as the people in the past were, as in today. Because like if you look at like a similar example from say today, like Stella Nyanzi, she's a Ugandan writer and academic who's very vocally critical against Museveni's government and different things within Ugandan society. And a lot of her criticisms tend to like she uses incredibly vulgar language as a sort of shock tactic and as a way to like get people to like wake up to like, you know, we live in overly polite, genteel societies and like we should be able to talk about these things. But the problem with that is that people focus on her language instead of the actual, you know,
issue
substance
itself
and content. Behind it, because people are just angry that because like she like says things like she like strips nude and like goes on protest completely nude and is like shouting like, you know, like making like sexual analogies to like President Museveni's scrotum and stuff like that, you know? And so it's like very, very, like, yeah, very obscene, very but like that's in the same tradition as a Ken Saro-Wiwa, as a Achebe, as a, you know, Ngugi. It's just a different tactic and like not nearly as well known or as celebrated of a name. I don't know if 20 years from now she may be, you know, like,
who knows,
considered
who
in
knows
the way that they are.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe this is how it starts. Maybe back in the 60s, people were looking down on, you know, on Googie and being like, this guy's like, what's he doing? You know, like, why is he causing ruckus? I don't know.
Because honestly, exactly. Actually, that's a funny thing about history. It's like, you know, I was listening to someone talk about James Baldwin and how celebrated he is today. But in the 60s, he couldn't even live in America. He mm-hmm. had to leave. He had to go to France where he could be, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. the full expression of himself at that time. His own people didn't really accept him. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, but like if 50 years mm-hmm. down the line, he's this, you know, black and, gay icon.
And the fascinating thing about that is that in France, he was able to be accepted because he was American. Because if he was black,
exactly. Not because he was black.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which is actually very, very interesting. What do you think the role of a writer is in an unjust society, as many societies like we grew up in are? You know, I mean,
I honestly think that every society is unjust, if we're being honest. You know, like,
yeah, that's true.
I don't know any society in this world
that's
that
perfect.
Is, like, you know, yeah, or that is even like equitable. You know, for everybody. Because like there are going to be like people suffering like in some places some people are suffering less than others, yeah, but mm-hmm. there's always going to be somebody who's, you know, at the bottom of the barrel. But as far as the responsibilities of a writer, like for me, I don't know, because I am like a marginalized individual in so many different ways, like I can't help but move through the world and move through my writing in a way that sort of does like is like in some way politically active, you know? And so like I don't understand writers who feel like they can write and like be completely like
apolitical.
Like, yeah, apolitical. Like I think that's a privilege thing. You know, and so it's just something that I don't get. But it's also, I believe, like a selfish thing, you know? And
yeah.
So like for me, the politics is inherently baked into my identity, and so therefore it comes out in my writing. But I think that like one of the primary responsibilities of a writer is just to use their words responsibly.
What most excites you about the writing coming out of the continent today?
The writing coming up on the continent today. What most excites me about the writing coming up on the continent today is the independent nature of a lot of writing going on. Because I come from like a very like indie background, and I like champion the indies and like like have a lot of love and respect, because like so the writing world is very, very similar to the music world,
and then every creative world generally, actually.
Yeah. But these two are very, very, very clear parallels in the power structures and the business structures within them.
I agree.
Because in the music world, there are five big records. There's like Sony, Universal, blah, blah, blah. Mm. There's like five big record labels. And those five run 90% of the music industry worldwide. 90. Governed by these five. And then the 10% is everyone else, right?
Mm.
And like everyone else is like hundreds of thousands of like small independent record labels and just people doing it by themselves. And so the publishing world is the same, that like five publishers run everything, and then 10% is everyone else. And one thing that excites me very much on the continent that's happening a lot more of late and is a like recent trend is the number of independent presses and small presses that establishing and blowing up and growing themselves across the continent, which like I like have like a lot of love and respect for, and like have like done partnerships with, because like the big five are all established outside of the continent, right? And so in order to get a publishing deal with a Random House or a HarperCollins or whatnot, you have
exactly
in Europe or the US, you know, like mm-hmm. I can't negotiate one from Kampala right now, you know? And so it's like, it privileges the people who can afford to go out, who like, you know, like get, you know, the MFA scholarship or whatnot, or can just like have the money to like, you know?
Definitely. I mean, even the earlier writers on the continent were all like, you know, funded by big presses like Heinemann. You know, these were big.
Yeah. And all of them had some sort of a relationship where, like, they'd done some time in the UK or they'd done, you know, like indeed. None of them were, like, you know, like born and brought up in the continent their entire lives, you know, like all of them had, like, I've done the same thing. And it's like, it's a necessary thing in order to get to a certain place, you know?
Indeed.
Like you can't get to a certain level without a cosign from the West. Like I've noticed, like when I published my book, I published it in Canada. Then when I came back to Uganda, I had so much hype and love because I was published in the West and now I was bringing it home.
Exactly.
You know, like if I'd published it in Uganda first, nobody would have come. But when indeed. They heard, oh, this guy who was like published in Canada and then when I did my tour and I came back, it was like, wow, this guy toured the West and now he's coming back home and doing a show here. This is huge, you know? And it's like, why don't I get the same love for like, but like, it's ironic because when I tour East Africa, when I go to the West, they're like, wow, you did 3 countries in Africa? Wow, and now you're coming to do your 4th country? Wow, that's, you know? And so it's like big, like having the African cosign helps in the West and having the Western cosign helps in Africa. And so it just benefits each other mutually.
Exactly.
I have a lot of, but like, that's why I'm grateful for all these independent presses.